Morning. Good morning. Welcome to CSIS. We've tried to put out an extra amount of water today for those of you who've walked long distances and need to hydrate. I'm Steve Morrison, director of the CSIS Center for Global Health Policy. We're delighted to come together again this year with our partner, the Kaiser Family Foundation, Jen Cates, the senior vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, to review the outcome of the G8 and this year also the G20, with special focus on development and global health issues. This is, I believe it's the sixth consecutive year that we've done this jointly with Kaiser. It's proven to be a very valuable tradition, and particularly to hear the reflections, the sort of reflections while they're still fresh from those policymakers who are at the table. And we have today Ambassador Len Edwards and NSC Director Mark Abdu, who've kindly agreed to join us. And so we're very delighted to have them with us. I'll come back to them in a moment. Our partnership with Kaiser is among the most valuable that we have enjoyed over the last decade. Kaiser is a very exceptional institution. It's an operating foundation populated with great talent and sets the gold standard for data analysis and policy insights into health. We'll hear from Jen in a few minutes some of the most recent data, 2001-2008, on OECD commitments. Ambassador Len Edwards kindly agreed to come to Washington to be with us today. He is the special representative of the Canadian Prime Minister to the summits, the Sherpa in the diplomatic language for the summits. He's the former, June, he stepped down as the deputy foreign minister. He has consecutively served as the deputy minister in three different agencies. Departments going back 9 years, foreign affairs, agriculture, and trade, and served as ambassador to Japan and to Korea, has had a very distinguished career. We're also very delighted to have Mark Abdu with us today. Mark is the director for global health and food security on the National Security Council at the White House. Prior to that, served in many positions at Health and Human Services, most recently as the acting deputy director of the Office of Global Health Affairs. He's had extensive experience over the last several years in the various diplomatic fora in preparing for the G8 and handling many other issues, including the preparation of the accountability report that we'll hear more about today. And so brings a wealth of experience on these matters. While I'm on this, I want to quickly thank a number of people who contributed to making this event happen. Seth Gannon, Daniel Porter, Carolyn Schroat, Asad Moten, Catherine Streifel, Lizzie Cohen, Suzanne Brundage from CSIS. From Kaiser, Craig Pulaski and Adam Wexler have been very helpful. And from the Canadian Embassy, Frank Ruddock. And we're joined today also from Ottawa, Ron Garson and Tracy Fife. And great to see you both here today. We'll hear more this morning about the moment of big transition that's underway. I'm going to say a few words about that big transition in terms of the way that the G8 and G20 are evolving. We'll hear a brief presentation from Jen Cates on the data that they've just issued, and then we will move to our two presenters, Ambassador Edwards and Mark Abdu, and then we will have a discussion, and as part of that discussion, open to the floor for comments from you. The G8 is an old club. It's an old and small club of liberal democracies, of dominant donors, dating back to 1975. It's important to remember that it didn't really begin to embrace seriously global health and development issues until the second half of the 90s, and that didn't really accelerate until this last decade. It's an organization that over time has acquired a pretty broad agenda of economics, development, security, conflict issues. It has strong, obviously strong constituencies, both in the alignment with the developing world, but also internally with non-governmental groups and advocacy groups, and many of you who are represented here today. In the last decade, there's been enormous activism by the G8. And I think when you see the data that Jen Cates is going to present on the period 2001 to 2008, it's rather dramatic the way the numbers were driven up during that period in terms of commitments on global health. And I think the G8 can claim predominant credit for having driven that process forward. There are many other high-impact contributions in the last decade, the Global Fund, Gavi Alliance, many particular initiatives certainly surrounding HIV/AIDS, but then broadening in recent years. We are clearly at a turning point and an uncertain turning point in terms of the G8's future and its role. And I'll just quickly highlight. First is the decision taken at Muskoka to retire the Glen Eagle commitments, which was controversial, difficult, somewhat embarrassing, and to move on. And this was really a decision that was taken that at the five-year mark, it was time to retire this and move forward. That was an admission that things had become more difficult. I think it was an admission that the protracted global recession, the worsening debt and deficit situations in many of the G8 countries were such that you weren't going to see a quick turnaround. It also means that we see a concentration of leadership and continued funding in just a small core of states, US, Canada, UK in particular. The accountability mechanism that was rolled out at Muskoka, very important, a very new development in terms of peer review and data collection. Canada deserves enormous credit for having driven that process forward. Others like Mark, who contributed directly to that, will hear more about that. It will continue to be a live presence in the future in evaluating performance and guidance. We'll hear more today about the MCH initiative, the $5 billion five-year commitment, and how that was created, how that will move forward. It is an important initiative. It's modest. It's important. There are continued questions around implementation and coordination issues. So there's this unresolved question of what is the G8's future phase, and hopefully we'll hear more from our speakers today about what kind of continued catalytic role it's going to play under these circumstances. Now, on the G20, we also have a transition underway there. It's a new entity by comparison, only 2 years old. Uncertain membership and mandate. It was created in the midst of the 2008 economic crisis to bring about greater coordination of emerging economies. It has yet to demonstrate really its ability to fulfill the kind of commitments made going back to the last several meetings around the G20 with respect to bringing about much closer coordination on financial management, exiting the debt, stimulus, exiting the stimulus commitments, managing debt and deficit. What role will it play on development and global health in the long term is an open question. The Koreans have created the new working group on development. There's been some initial outreach in New York at the UN with the World Bank. There's more continuing looking forward, and I hope we'll hear more about that today. But I think when we look at the G20, we need to keep in mind that there are many countervailing pressures operating upon it, many of which would argue not to enlarge the agenda around development and global health in any rushed fashion. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of caution and care moving forward. There are the G20 members, the G13, the emerging economies, are certainly seeing a much stronger stake in the developing world. Their engagement is matching the power and force in the developing world of the G8 countries. The G8 troubles are creating a space for them to get involved. Development and global health are promising opportunities. The G20 has already gotten its feet wet in a number of these areas, creating now this new committee on development. Those are the forces that are sort of pulling them in that direction, but I think there's also others that will push for quite a bit of caution. The emerging powers have very special sensitivities around accountability, transparency, disclosure of data. We can talk more about that. They do not have strong domestic constituencies arguing for them to take on new commitments outside their borders in the developing world. And there's the immediate pressure to do first things first. That is to focus on those immediate macroeconomic policy coordination, regulatory reform, control of debt, exit strategies, all of those economic crisis obligations that are still yet to be really worked out. And there's also great questions around where's the leadership going to come from to move the G20 forward on these. And there are clearly risks. Climate change stalled as it moved into the G20 orbit. There's no question that international property rights, that viral sovereignty, that all of these issues, if put into a G20 context, might themselves invite more tension and deadlock than they do in terms of inviting forward progress. So with those words, thank you very much for being so patient and for being here with us. I'll invite Jen to show us some quick data. Thank you.
Sure. I see that Steve's already started to go through my slide presentation. Good morning, everyone. I want to echo Steve's welcome, particularly to our guests from the Canadian government and the U.S. government who kindly came to talk about the G8 and the experience that they recently went through at the G8. Also want to acknowledge our important long-term partnership with CSIS on this briefing, but also on many, many things, as Steve mentioned. It's really been invaluable to us as a health organization that focuses on health policy issues to be able to partner with a foreign policy entity and bring those two perspectives together. So what we've always felt with this briefing is that we all spend so much energy focusing on what will happen at the G8, and then during the G8, what is happening at the G8. And I think it's important to do a readout on what actually did happen and not lose that momentum, because it is after the summits where important things should or continue to happen. And at every G8, we look to see what will be the focus, what will be the issues that are elevated. Will health rise to a top agenda item? And if so, what will be the topic? And as Steve mentioned, health has not always been at the top, although in the last decade or so, that's really changed. And I would say for the most part, it's been very HIV-focused. Also at the G8, we look to see what commitments were made. So what we know about this G8 is that there was a health issue at the top of the agenda. It was on maternal and child health, and some new commitments were made. And these are important for looking at markers and measuring going forward. What these commitments will lead to is sort of the key question that a lot of us are focusing on now. And to help set the stage a little bit, I'm going to, in a sense, do a retrospective, kind of look back and see where the G8 has been. It's not just the G8, but the G8 forms the bulk of most of the donor government assistance on global health. And when we do this report every year where we look at data reported to the OECD by DAC governments on their global health funding commitments and just try to get a sense of trends. I will just one thing that we also do is we look at health broadly. We include health, which is basic health care, general health issues, as well as population and reproductive health, which is where HIV and STD programs fall, as well as reproductive health programs, and water and sanitation related to health. So we've used an expanded definition. As this was up before, and I think there's some notable things in this slide, we also are releasing this report now. The report's out there, so I'm just going to spend a couple minutes on a few things. You can see the increase over time overall in official development assistance. That's the total numbers at the top. You can also see over that time that health is actually growing as a share of that. What you can't see here is some of the reasons behind this, and that's in our report, particularly this very large jump between 2007 and 2008, which we noticed, and we thought, well, what was going on there? There were several things driving that are really important for thinking about going forward. A lot of that increase was due to economic infrastructure projects that are not health-related. A portion of that increase was due to ODA for Iraq, Afghanistan, a portion for debt relief, and some of it due to currency exchange fluctuations. So a lot of these things, when you take them out of the equation, there's still an increase, but not as dramatic. And then, of course, the global economic crisis. And this becomes really important because one of the challenges to analyzing any of these data is that there's a real lag. And so when we were able to look at the quote-unquote most recent data, we're looking at budgeting decisions that were made before the global economic crisis really hit. So this is, as Steve said, this is really about the G8's legacy and the donor government legacy on global health, more looking back and not clear going forward. This just breaks down those total amounts over time by the sectors. The main point to take away here is that health has risen as a share of overall development assistance. It's always been favored as an area. Other big areas are economic infrastructure, multi-sector, which is combines a lot of different things that doesn't fall into these other categories. We also, speaking of this 2007 to 2008 increase, we were really curious what was driving that increase. What were the factors that contributed to a $31 billion increase in official development assistance over that one-year period? And you can see here it breaks it down by the different sectors that drove it. And the biggest thing, as I mentioned earlier, was the economic infrastructure projects. also multi-sector efforts and commodity aid. Health drove 10%, but it certainly wasn't the biggest driver, as we wouldn't expect it to be. But this is, I think, is a helpful gauge as to what was driving that increase. We also always look at the donors that are contributing to health ODA. And as you can see here, the U.S. is the largest, and that's increased over time. And then by region, Sub-Saharan Africa is the largest region, and that's also increased over time. And again, all of these data are in the report. So this is just a flag for you. And one thing I'm not showing here is the subsectors of health. So if you look below these numbers, you can see what's driving the increase in health, and it's largely been HIV/AIDS funding. So a few take-home messages and a sort of a forward look. I think, you know, it's very clear ODA for health has increased over the period that we looked at, even if you adjust for inflation and exchange rate and look at all these other factors. But some real caveats to think about. The first being, as I mentioned, the lag in data. And the budgeting decisions that we're looking at here were before the crisis. So it's not clear what that will mean for next year or beyond that. And we've already seen a slowing growth rate in health. I didn't show that here, but it has been slowing. So is there caution that's warranted going forward? On the one hand, as we see from the G8, there's still attention to global health. There's the new initiative that was launched. There's the MDG review summit in the fall. There's the GHI by the U.S. government. So there's still a lot of momentum around putting forth global health initiatives. On the other, if you look at the OECD's recent data on what's happening with official development assistance writ large, not on health, but just generally, it's actually relatively level between 2009 and 10, even in real and nominal terms. And some donors are actually decreasing and some are increasing. So it's not clear what this will mean. So going forward, it'd be really important to monitor how health fares in that equation and look at other markers in the near term, since there's such a lag in the data. One marker, for example, is that what we'll talk about today is the fulfillment of some of these commitments. The other is to look at countries like the U.S., the U.K. that tend to be the biggest donors and see what their funding amounts actually are. Global Fund replenishment is in the fall, the MDG summit. These are all forward markers. I'll also flag a report that we're going to release in about a week and a half on funding for AIDS by donor governments, which will actually provide some new data, more recent than this, which will give, I think, a little bit of a picture as to what might be happening. And just to wrap up, one thing to bring up Steve's point on the G20, I think the question of the G20 as donors is an important one to think about. If you look at the G20, there are 10 G20 members that are not in the DAC. And of these, 5 were Global Fund donors, 3 donated to Gavi, and 2 to UNITAID. So they are poised in some fashion to potentially be donors. And 6 of these non-DAC G20 members are classified by the World Bank as upper-income countries. So what their role is will be important to monitor going forward. With that, we will hopefully hear from our government experts about what we can think about looking forward. Thanks.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you, Stephen, for the very kind introduction. It's very good to be here. I'm pleased to see Washington's a tiny bit hotter than Ottawa. I thought I was getting out of the hot town, but I came to a hotter one. It's great to be here for a number of reasons, the weather perhaps being not one of them, but to actually have a chance to talk a bit about the summits. It's only been a week and 3 days since we wrapped up 2 back-to-back summits in Toronto and in Muskoka. And I think it's probably unique that any country has really organized these size of events back to back with them. And they truly were, I believe, quite an extraordinary set of events and conjunction of issues and so forth, as what I think has been pointed out as what used to be a single summit that we developed countries looked forward to around the G8 has now become a series of G8 and G20 summits. And I'm pleased to comment on that, and of course in our discussion period which follows. I think what I'm going to do in order to set the stage for a good discussion is focus primarily on the G8 and talk a bit about the health aspects of the G8. Well, first a few general comments about how we approached this G8, and this is against the background of the fact that the G20 has been created. My Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, was very clear to me what he wanted when we set out on this road last September, really, to start to work on these two summits. He wanted to have Canada look at the G8 and go to what he called a back-to-basics approach. And by that, it means to really try and find where the true value added of the G8 lies in a world in which we now have the G20, part of this evolutionary process that Stephen referred to. We felt that what we needed to do is play to the strengths of the G8, which is a group of leaders from developed countries, an organization where intimate and frank conversation is the norm, where we can deal with economic issues in passing, but pass those on to the G20, but where we could really focus on two areas of strength of the G8. And one was the development agenda, and the other was peace and security. Early on in the process, we then turned our attention to how we would approach the development agenda. And you know, as you know, it has been for some years now part of the practice in the G8 to get together with a group of African leaders. And Africa focus has always been a key part of the G8, and we decided to continue that practice. The Prime Minister ended up inviting seven African leaders to the summit. And then we turned our attention to what we would do under the development heading. And again, here the practice in the past has been to focus, and as has been described, health has been a growing and important part of the G8 development agenda. And we had to select something, and it became quickly evident, and the Prime Minister came to this decision back in December, that we would focus on MDGs 4 and 5, maternal and child health, or child and maternal health, I guess, to match up against the MDGs. That this was something that fit well with the progress into 2010 when the UN would be holding its MDG summit in September, the high-level conference to review the implementation of the MDGs. And the two MDGs where progress has been least were MDGs 4 and 5. It didn't take very long in shopping this idea around. Here in Washington, of course, it received extremely favorable response. And in other capitals, to realize that this was really, you might say, a no-brainer, that this was an area where the world was crying out for attention, and where the strength of the G8 as a catalyst, as a leader, as a convener, could really be helpful going into 2010. So this is how we started the process, and I'll just describe a little bit of how we got to Muskoka. The work of the UN is important in this respect. The United Nations Secretary General is calling for a joint action plan, which is focusing on women's and child health. He had a meeting in April, which we went to. And we wanted to ensure that what we did focused very much and collaborated very much with what the UN was doing, so that we could, in fact, give a boost to the UN's efforts and it would be seen as part of it. Again, the logic was incontrovertible. Hundreds of thousands of women die each year as a result of pregnancy and childbirth, and progress on child mortality is slow and uneven. Millions of children die each year, even before their fifth birthday. And as you all know, as you follow this subject, millions of these deaths can actually be easily prevented through access to public health services that we take for granted in Canada and the United States and so on. So we did believe that the G8 could make a tangible difference in improving the health of women and children in developing countries. So we took a very straightforward approach as the chair of the G8. We went and saw the World Health Organization. They told us that the game changers would be to focus on health systems to ensure availability of public health services along the full continuum of care from pre-pregnancy to childhood. We took their advice, and working with our G8 partners, including the United States, of course, very much at the forefront of this effort, We focus the initiative squarely on scaling up investments in health systems to improve access to health services, as I said, along this continuum of care. For example, sexual and reproductive health care and services, including family planning, the ability to give birth in a healthy facility attended by trained health workers, pre- and postnatal visits with a health care worker, childhood immunizations, well, you know it, prevention and treatment of HIV, AIDS, malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia, safe drinking water, sanitation, and nutritious food. So once we determined where what we would include in this, and there was a fairly significant work went into this within the G8, working with the OECD and others, we then focused on the issue of securing new resources. And what we wanted to get here, and I emphasize this, was new and additional money. We wanted to scale up investments to support the services we've just identified. And with its launch at the summit, G8 members committed to, as you've heard, $5 billion in new and additional financing for maternal and child health out to 2015. Now, let me emphasize that this is new money. There's nothing double counted. There's no recycled announcements. There's no robbing Peter to pay Paul. This is all new. We're also extremely confident that this figure will increase significantly in the years to come. And as the declaration out of Muskoka says, we expect to mobilize significantly more than $10 billion by 2015. So that was the G8 portion. But there's much more to this initiative. And indeed, it was part of it right from the beginning, because very quickly we reached out to other countries to join us and to see whether or not they would be interested in building a partnership around this initiative, even though they weren't going to be in Muskoka, if they would be ready to have their contributions listed in the declaration, have their countries listed in the declaration. And so, Netherlands, Norway, New Zealand, Republic of Korea, Spain, Switzerland, all joined in and are mentioned in our Muskoka communique. We then went to the foundations, and here I pay particular tribute to the Gates Foundation, who stepped forward at a very critical time to announce a $1.5 billion sum over 5 years. This was hugely energizing to the whole process. And for those governments within the G8 that were still thinking about it, it sent a signal that this was a very serious initiative and that we had strong outside support. The United Nations Foundation also joined in, and there were others as well. So what we had at the end of the day was a $5 billion commitment from the G8, joined with a $2.3 billion commitment from non-G8 sources, both government and non-governmental. I think this is the special thing about the Muskoka initiative, and that is it's more than a G8 initiative. And it played to what I said earlier are part of the strengths of the G8, its ability to catalyze, its ability to convene. And so this so coalition of the committed, you might call it, which we rolled out in Muskoka, I think sets a very important example of what the G8 can do, and what we can even do in constrained economic circumstances. And the coalition, I think, this approach, this partnership approach, which has been used before, but in this particular instance around new and additional resources, provides a good example for further efforts going forward. Now, we see that the coalition have committed broadening in the months ahead. In fact, later this month, the African Union Summit will be held in Kampala. It, too, is chosen maternal and infant and child health as its theme for the summit. And as I said, we have been working very, very closely with the United Nations, and the UN Secretary General is leading development of a joint action plan on the health of women and children for agreement at the September MDG summit. For Canada, if I may put in an advertisement for my own country, we committed of that $5 billion, $1.1 billion. Which, in fact, adds to, I believe I'm right here, $1.75 billion that we already spend on this, and for 2.85, I think, total. Am I right, Tracy, on this? So a part of the figures that you see for the G8 Canada is a significant contributor. We hope, of course, that this ongoing effort that we have been part of will result in some significant further resources at the MDG summit in September. Now, something about accountability, and that is that we have built that into our plans. We work closely with leading agencies and institutions such as the OECD, the World Bank, and others to define what would be included in the funds, and now we have set up a tracking mechanism to do this. I'm going to come back to accountability in a second, but let me just turn quickly to the other thing we followed up at, in Muskoka, and that was food security. The L'Aquila Food Security Initiative was launched, as you know, with $22 billion committed towards sustainable agricultural development. The only other issue that, apart from maternal health, that we really focused on at Muskoka was to continue to drive this initiative. This was an initiative of President Obama's last year. We joined in. We put $600 million on the table to help meet our share of the commitment. So we've been working closely with the United States and with others, other G8 partners, to ensure that this commitment is made. The accountability process around L'Aquila fed into, in fact, the accountability report, which, as others have pointed out, is a bit of a landmark achievement for the Muskoka Summit. Let me now turn my attention then to the accountability. I know that you have some interest in this, and perhaps I could just cover that before I conclude. Accountability, we believe, is one of the outstanding features of the Muskoka Summit. I remember last year in Italy when Prime Minister Harper mentioned this at the leaders' meeting, that he was going to make accountability a foundation piece for the G8 going forward. He had at the back of his mind, that again, the credibility of the G8 had to rest on being accountable. And we had long been criticized by NGOs and by our developing partners in the third world and elsewhere that we made big fancy statements, but we didn't live up to the words. And so we felt that we had to bring a new spirit of accountability to the G8. It was always our sense that the G8 had a good story to tell in development. Not a perfect story, but a good story, but we needed to improve the telling of it. So we're very pleased that with our presidency and with the support and leadership of others in the G8, we did release the Muskoka Accountability Report, assessing action and results against development-related commitments. The report shows that the G8 is advancing credible responses to meet development challenges. For example, between 2004-2009, G8 development assistance increased by over 40% to more than US$82.2 billion. The G8 has provided about 80% of all resources to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. The G8 provides about 50% of all funds to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. G8 members have canceled significant levels of debt, referred to earlier, freeing billions of dollars for developing countries to use more productively. The G8 has played a leading role strengthening countries' capacities to prevent and resolve conflict. In fact, the G8 has surpassed its commitment in this respect. We said we would train 75,000 troops for peace operations by 2010. We have actually done 130,000 troops. A direct outcome of G8 support is increasingly effective African Union-led peace missions. However, this is not a perfect story, as I said, and we were prepared to find ourselves falling short in a number of areas. While Canada, the United States, and the United Kingdom have met our national Glen Eagles commitments on aid volumes, some G8 members have further to go. We need to remain focused on the L'Aquila food security commitments as well to ensure we achieve the $20 billion that were the objective. There were $22 billion pledged. This is a landmark document. I think for the G8 going forward, it has to become an annual exercise. And I'm pleased to say that the French, who will be hosting next year, have already identified that food security and health will be the focus of the 2011 accountability exercise. The accountability report helps to further ensure continuity and attention to earlier centennial G8 commitments. Maybe just a final word then about the G20. It's been referred to and perhaps there'll be some discussion shortly on this, but I think that this is a work in progress. The G20 agenda, as it broadens and takes on other issues, will likely see a greater convergence in subject matter between it and the G8. The area of development is the one where I think the jury is still out as to what can happen. Now, of course, you know, the G20 is already involved in development issues right from the very beginning. Part of the outcomes, and I refer to London particularly, were around the resourcing of international financial institutions. And indeed, in Toronto, we celebrated success by concluding the general capital increases for the multilateral development banks, which put about $350 billion new dollars at the disposal of the banks and doubled the amount of lending capacity available. We also launched something called the SME Challenge. If any of you are interested, you probably know about it already, but this is quite an innovative new financing approach. And we canceled Haiti's debt. So where's the G20 going to go on development? It will certainly deepen at the Seoul summit. Korea has made it clear as the next chair they would like to see development as to be a centerpiece or one of the centerpieces of their summit. They have several themes they'll be pursuing, but this is certainly one they want to pursue. And we in Toronto saw the launch of a working group under the Sherpas that will help define the scope and subject matter for Korea's development plans. Our first meeting of that group actually is going to be taking place later this month, and I think there's even a preparatory call this week that my staff will be participating in. When you look at the areas, they're very broad. The paper that has been circulated, I believe, at the UN just in the last few days talks about 9 areas: infrastructure, human resources development, trade, financial inclusion, food security, already there in a way, governance, something called the platform for knowledge sharing, and the list goes on. Personally, I think that this is very much a work in progress, as I said. The Koreans themselves realize that greater focus is going to have to be brought to this agenda by the time Seoul rolls around, and it's only 4 months away. I expect that there's some hard work to be done here. I still think, though, that there is a complementarity between the G20 and the G8, even in the development area. The G8 represents still the major donors. The G20 represents, I think, an opportunity to discuss the broader role that development plays in economic recovery. I think that the inclusion of additional African members as participants in the G20, as we did in Toronto, we had Malawi representing the African Union and Ethiopia, NEPAD, offers an opportunity for the developing world to be part of the new framework which came out of Pittsburgh and which was confirmed in Toronto. So I see development in that sense very much at home in the G20 and providing a lot of I think, very interesting opportunities for engagement. And, of course, it will bring in the new emerging economies that need to play their bigger role on development. So I think the differing nature of the two groups will still mean the two groups have specific roles in development, and it'll be distinct for some time to come. Of course, one can never predict the future, and as was pointed out, the role of the G8 has itself evolved considerably over time, which then takes me back to your comment, Stephen, about the fact that in the mid-90s we weren't doing much on health, and now it's a major part of what we do. So I expect some of the G20 work is also going to evolve in that fashion. Perhaps I'll conclude with these comments, and I look forward to our discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jen and Steve. It's great to be here, and it's particularly a privilege to be on this panel with our Canadian colleague, Ambassador Edwards. And kudos to the Canadians for doing a great job in getting us to a number of significant outcomes, including the Muskoka MCH initiative. And it's no small feat that the Canadians were able to pull off two back-to-back summits of this complexity and to this degree of success. They were even able, actually, to get the health experts all to eat antelope in Geneva at that matter. And so you know the level of planning and detail that they have put into developing the summit. I'm not going to focus much on the G20, other than to say that I do agree with Ambassador Edwards that it is a work in progress, the G20's relationship to development, and that we'll know more coming out of the Seoul summit as to what that work in progress is transforming into. I would say that it strikes me that the G20 is a sort of logical place to focus on economic growth and broad-based growth as a driver of development and making the next generation of emerging economies that can join the global economy and foster sustainable outcomes to basic human service needs for their people. Instead, I'm going to focus on a few things related to the G8, mainly global health, and their accountability, the MCH initiative, and development. As a backdrop to the G8 summit, our President Obama, recently released his national security strategy. In that strategy, the U.S. recognizes development as a moral, strategic, and economic imperative. Countries that achieve sustained development gains are more capable partners. They can engage in and contribute to the global economy, and they provide citizens with the opportunity, means, and freedom to improve their lives. The president will also be issuing a new development policy in the near future, and at the start of the Muskoka summit, he previewed that policy in a fact sheet called the New U.S. Approach to Development. It's on whitehouse.gov for those who are interested. And this development policy will focus on sustainable development outcomes by promoting broad-based economic growth, democratic governance, investing in game-changing innovations that have the potential to solve long-standing development challenges, and building effective public sector capacity to provide basic services over the long term. The policy also puts a premium on selectivity, leveraging the expertise and resources of others, mutual accountability, and on evidence of impact. This new approach served as the foundation for the outcomes the U.S. hoped to help achieve at the summit. With regard to accountability, President Obama takes accountability very seriously, and I think both the Global Food Security Initiative and the Global Health Initiative ably demonstrate this. Canada showed tremendous leadership in coordinating a serious accountability process and an accountability report that provides a candid assessment of G8 efforts. In health, we're doing pretty well, though there's certainly much more that needs to be done. The report is pretty frank about G8 countries' achievements and failures, and it makes clear that we need to redouble our efforts to meet our commitments. That's remarkable progress from where we were just a few years ago in the nascent accountability exercises under the German and Japanese presidencies. Just as donors ask our partners in the developing world to honor their commitments, we need to meet ours. This is tough, especially in tight budget times. But the credibility of both our governments and the G8 depends on it. And we do our partners and ourselves no service or favors when we make commitments and fail to honor them. This commitment to accountability and transparency guided our approach to the Canadian Muskoka MCH initiative. 4 months into office, I'm sure you all know, President Obama signaled an increased emphasis on maternal and child health when he announced the six-year, $63 billion Global Health Initiative. The Muskoka Initiative, which will reduce the number of maternal, newborn, and under-five child deaths in developing countries by supporting strengthened country-led health systems and enabling the delivery of key interventions along the continuum of care, complements that increased emphasis and in ways builds on it. The GHI has been clear and transparent in what it will achieve over 6 years. The targets are out there, everybody's seen them, and most of the global health world has commented on them, it seems, from the level of mail we've gotten about the initiative. We took that lens to Muskoka. Our objective was to work with our G8 partners to ensure outcomes were the headline for the initiative. Of course, to achieve outcomes, we need funding. That's a given. But in the G8 context and in the development field more broadly, we've tended to focus too much on funding inputs and not enough on what we hoped that funding would achieve. We needed to change that, and under Canadian leadership, we did pretty well in terms of putting outcomes first when we make commitments and relying on data and evidence to guide our interventions. Our metric for success, of course, shouldn't be dollars spent, but instead actual lives saved. When it came time for the United States to make its funding commitment, we also wanted to be credible, transparent, and accountable. Having a big number in a communique is great, but if we do that and don't deliver the goods later, as I said earlier, we do our partners and ourselves no favors. And it's better for our partners, to be perfectly honest, to know exactly what we're committing and what they can expect, and they can then bank on that. These principles are particularly important in times of fiscal constraint, and we owe it both to our domestic constituencies and to those we hope to help through our assistance to be absolutely clear as to what we're committing. So we took credibility, transparency, and accountability into account when we announced our commitment to the MCH initiative. That commitment was $1.346 billion above our fiscal year 2008 baseline. That commitment covers our fiscal years 2010 and 2011 and is in support of both the MCH initiative and programming through the Global Health Initiative. The U.S. commitment is, as far as we can tell, the largest commitment over the 2008 baseline to the Muskoka Initiative. And when you add the baseline with our commitment itself, it is roughly $2.6-something billion dollars. What this doesn't represent, to be perfectly transparent, is additional funding commitments above what the President announced in May 2009 in total for the Global Health Initiative. Our number is derived from the MCH family planning and malaria elements of enacted levels in fiscal year 2010 and the fiscal year 2011 President's budget. And on the malaria level, it's imputed at 89%, given that malaria interventions, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, are overwhelmingly targeted at under 5 children and women of reproductive age. We only were able to commit 2 years at this point in time to the Muskoka Initiative. This commitment, again, is based on the President's approach to development and the new business model we're implementing through the Global Health Initiative, both of which rely on rigorous evaluation of the impact of our programming to guide decisions related to future funding commitments. The good news is that the global health field has grown and matured. We've learned a great deal over the last decade about what works and what doesn't, and about the difference between inputs and outcomes, and about the importance and availability of the facts that can drive our analysis. So we plan on using the data and evidence generated through the implementation of the GHI in fiscal year 2010 and 2011 as the basis for determining our global health funding allocations for fiscal year 2012. In terms of the specific interventions in the Muskoka Initiative, one of the great things about it is it's not too prescriptive. There are there's a general body of evidence about what's needed and what's worked. And G8 and the other partners in this initiative are able to implement those according to their policy and programming objectives and priorities. What this presents is an opportunity. In order to really make sustainable progress, the President believes that we need to begin to forge a deliberative division of labor. We don't all need to be working in the same field, in the same place. We need to play to our respective added value. And so this is something that I hope as we move forward in implementing the MCH initiative, we can really take a look at to see how we can leverage each other's strengths to afford greater coverage and create better outcomes for the people that we're trying to help. So I think that was probably enough of me talking, and I'm going to stop there. And thanks again for coming.
Thank you very much, Mark and Lynn. I'm going to ask Jen to kick off our discussion here with a question. Would you like to do that?
I actually do have a question for Lynn, specific to what the French are already beginning to talk about regarding next year's summit. What has been stated thus far? What will be the next steps? I mean, I think a lot of, rather than lose momentum to think about the G8 going forward, we should all be thinking about what the points of intervention or opportunity are going forward. So.
Well, it's a tough question to ask because France isn't represented on this panel. And I don't want to venture into ground where I'm speaking on behalf of my French colleagues. All we know is that, as I said earlier, that the accountability approach will be continued by the French, and that we're going to be focusing on the two areas I mentioned, food security and maternal and child health. With respect to G8 practice, however, the next presidency really doesn't begin to make its plans known until into the autumn, and then they only assume presidency in January. So I think we'll have to be a little patient to before we can get a clear sense of what the French are going to pursue. But I think it's fair to say that all members of the G8 believe strongly that the G8 must continue to deliver value, must continue to focus on its core competencies, and I expect that the French will continue to ensure that the G8 plays a very, very strong and useful role next year. That's a diplomatic answer.
It works.
Hope you don't mind.
Appreciate it.
Let me just follow up there. What I hear from your two presentations with respect to the G8 is that certainly on behalf of the Canadian government and the United States government, a continued faith and belief in the value of the G8 in driving forward development agenda, a big shift towards the accountability and measurement of impacts, a focus in the near term upon two principal issues of the Food Security Initiative and the MCH, and this kind of outreach function of trying to, in the midst of constrained budgets and tighter scrutiny of where the dollars are going, not only are you looking towards stronger accountability mechanisms, but you're also, you got to look outside yourselves to new partners, right? And so the G8 is doing that. Now, on the G20, I hear you saying that it's a work in progress. There is this division between, I mean, the G20 contains the G8, and it contains the emerging markets. It contains the non-DAC. It contains very wealthy countries that are large emerging markets that have quite a bit of resources that mostly are going towards internal purposes, or they may have elaborated foreign assistance programs like China does that are highly branded and highly bilateral. So if the G8 is looking to continue to push in this way, accountability with a focus on a couple of core issues like food security, maternal and child health, I assume also the HIV/AIDS agenda does not fall away. The malaria agenda, as we've heard from Mark, that does not fall away either. How does the G8 imagine crossing that divide in order to bring the powerful emerging economies, which have become donors unto themselves with equal, if not greater, power and influence in the developing world in terms of the marketplace, for the struggle for influence? If you look at the numbers in terms of trade, concessionary financing, bilateral direct assistance, the Chinese are shoulder to shoulder with any of the G8 donors, and you can make a similar argument, less dramatic, but a similar argument for some of the other BRICS countries. How do you imagine the G8 leadership, the UK, the US, Canada, cracking that nut and trying to pull into these coalitions those that are absent today? I mean, your MCH had a little bit of modest Korean involvement, but it was really the end states, the New Zealand and Norway and Netherlands, and then a little from Switzerland and a little bit from whoever else I'm forgetting here. But there was not, it was notable that there was an absence of a commitment coming towards that MCH initiative from any of these powerful emerging markets, except for Korea making a modest commitment. Can you talk about that?
Well, in terms of a global health agenda for the G20, there clearly isn't one. And I think where the G20's real value add is as an entity that can figure out a pathway to help the very poor countries and developing countries mm-hmm. really access the global economy. And that's mm-hmm. Really what's needed for sustainable long-term economic growth and development across the board in many of those countries so that they can begin to put into place the policy decisions and legal and regulatory reforms that are really necessary to produce the types of development outcomes that lead to sustained provision of basic human needs and services. And so that's really where I think the value add is, and I think that mm-hmm. that's what the G20 is uniquely positioned to do and is moving in that direction under the Korean leadership.
But presumably when you were looking for donors towards the MCH initiative, you talked to the BRICS countries, right?
Well, we did some talking. But we, to be honest, we went to the countries where we felt that there was a ready opportunity mm-hmm. to create partnerships. This is an ongoing effort.
Yes.
I mean, it didn't end in Muskoka. Mm-hmm. And I think going into the review of the Millennium Development Goals of this September, getting to the UN context, this is when we begin to expand that partnership and engage them. I agree entirely with Mark, by the way, about the G20. I think the G20 has been very focused on its own core agenda around economic recovery mm-hmm. and the regulatory reforms and so on, with a good bit, as I pointed out, of contributions towards development with mm-hmm. the multilateral development banks and so on. And Toronto, in fact, called for a very healthy replenishment of the IDA under the World Bank mm-hmm. and the African Development Fund. So we see that playing there. I think if we can get within this context of a discourse around the global economic model mm-hmm. for the global economy of the future, in which developing countries, including the poorest, play a role, that would be, I think, a very important outcome from a so-called development agenda mm-hmm. In the G20. I worry, frankly, that if we go too quickly into too full a development agenda in the G20, we will lose our focus on the real core things mm-hmm. that we still have to accomplish in the G20, which is to get global recovery in place.
Yes. Can I follow up on that? I mean, when you look at what's happening in the creation of the development working group for the G20, it's been surprising to see the speed and the scope of outreach that has happened, right, in terms of the solicitation of input at the UN, the World Bank, and now a number of others, this paper that's circulating that's very broad, as you say, covers the full waterfront in terms of possibilities, 9 different categories. Can you comment a bit on that? I mean, I'm just quite surprised that the Koreans are taking that approach, because when you hear them talk publicly, they say, we are not opening a Pandora's box. We're going to open the window in a very controlled and focused fashion, because we understand what may happen along the line. But here we have a process. It looks quite different. It looks like a very much of a let's throw the doors open and hear what we hear.
Well, again, I can't speak for the French. I can't really speak for the Koreans either. But they have been close partners this year. We have mm-hmm. we've had these summits within the same year, and I know that from the Korean point of view that they still want to focus on these core issues that the G20 must continue mm-hmm. to drive forward. But I think that it's, as I said earlier, it's a bit of a work in progress. I think they've cast the net wide, but they know they're going to have to narrow it and focus it. And they also want to be inclusive, which I think is very healthy. It does pose challenges to management of the preparatory process when you engage so many outside the G20 in it. But there's no question that's a very healthy thing that they're trying to do. I just worry that the amount of time they have is very short. Mm-hmm. There are still many things we need to get done on the financial regulatory agenda, on the issues around stimulus versus combined with fiscal consolidation, two important messages out of Toronto, the need to continue to reform the IMF governance mm-hmm. structures, which are still falling behind, further replenishments of, as I said, the development funds. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to do in the G20. And if the Koreans can get a solid start on a very focused development agenda along the lines we've been discussing, I think that's a big plus.
Mark, could you have some thoughts?
I would agree with Ambassador Edwards that this is really a work in progress and that we're at the very beginning. As he noted, the first phone call on the development agenda under the Korean summit is tomorrow. And so it's likely that we'll see a considerable narrowing of the focus by the time we get to the fall. One of the really important things that this demonstrates is this notion of a division of labor. So if you've got the G8 working on more traditional development assistance or humanitarian assistance type projects, mm-hmm. Then not everybody from the G20 needs to jump on board there. There are other aspects of development as opposed to development assistance that we can deliberatively forge this division of labor so that we're all working to our respective strengths and achieving more than we would if we were duplicating our efforts mm-hmm. and being inefficient.
Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to get at that point of division of labor, or the flip side of being collaboration and coordination. And going back to the G8 specifically in Muskoka, one way to think about accountability going forward is what the delivery on the commitments is. The other way is how are the partners that have already agreed to be part of the Muskoka initiative in the G8 and elsewhere talked at all about coordinating their efforts to take advantage of who is best situated to do what interventions and use the opportunity as one for better coordination on the ground. I'd be curious to hear if that conversation is in the works or that came up in the discussion around the initiative.
Well, why don't I start, Mark? And you're closer to this accountability report than I was. But I know that on the accountability report, it's more than just numbers. Mm-hmm. We were looking at how money's being spent effectively, the impact that it's having, and so on. Now, admittedly, that too is a work in progress, because there are you need guidelines and so forth against which to measure effectiveness and so on. The numbers are one thing, and if you just focus on the numbers, you get a mixed picture. But you need to go beyond that. You also need to go beyond, and here's why I think the G8 has played an important role, is the catalytic nature of the aid that's put in place mm-hmm. and the changes that have been brought through these very significant sums that they put in place. And the accountability report does make some comment on that. In Muskoka, we had a chance, again, through our African leaders present, to talk about accountability. And a number of the African leaders in the room expressed their interest in following up on that discussion further. In fact, the AU, African Union, is doing their own accountability report, which is to be made public at some point over the course of the summer. And there is an interest in really joining these two efforts up. So you begin to look at the continuum of the donor accountability versus recipient accountability and everything in between, including those institutions we turn to help deliver plans and so forth that are in place to help deliver. So I think this is something, a very healthy development, which is going in a positive direction.
Sure. And I would say that the G8 process is a very important first step toward the larger joint action plan that will be launched at the MDG high-level plenary review. And that will also afford an opportunity for greater donor coordination. So I think implicit in the Muskoka initiative is a need for coordination, mm-hmm. Who's doing what and where and with whom. And that type of thinking is fundamental to the Global Health Initiative, in which we're trying to forge deliberate alliances both with our partners in governments and in private philanthropical organizations to align behind country-led plans to improve health systems. And I think that will carry through into the fall as we reach the high-level plenary.
Thank you. Let's open things up for comments and questions from the audience. Please put your hand up, and yes, right here. We're going to take three, and then we'll come back to our speakers. So please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Savannah Dennis from Population Action International.
Just speak up, yeah.
It is really important, especially for the credibility of the GA. So in that spirit, I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit more about the tracking mechanism, and specifically two things. In the mechanism reporting, how you plan to distinguish between new resources, or how the initiative plans to distinguish between new resources and resources that have already been committed. And then second of all, I want to really thank Canada for being very forthcoming in how much money they're committing and how much money they're already spending. But from my understanding, not all of the coalition of the committed has been so clear in terms of their role, how much funding they're putting into the initiative. So I was curious, in terms of reporting back on achievements towards the commitments, the coalition of the committed envisioned sort of reporting back on an aggregate level, or if the reporting would be by donor or by member. And second question for Mr. Abdu, I wasn't exactly clear from your comments how much of the U.S.'s $1.3 billion was additional, if any. I was a little bit confused, so if you could talk about that a bit more. Thank you.
Hold for a moment. Let's take a couple of additional. Princeton Lyman. The back.
Thank you. Princeton Lyman, Council on Foreign Relations. I'd like to follow up a little bit on that last comment with Jennifer and others on accountability on the recipient side. As you know, African governments committed to no less than 15% of their budgets for health and 10% for agriculture, and almost none of them have done so. How do you press this forward? I know it'll come up at the summit, but what's the strategy at the MDG summit, and even more in the implementation of programs, to get that kind of a buy-in? Otherwise, these programs just won't be sustainable.
Thank you. We take one more, and then we'll come back to our speakers. Yes, right in front here. There's a microphone coming right here.
Okay, thank you to Mr. Edward.
Can you please identify yourself?
Oh, yeah. My name is Sion. I come from 20 hours flight from Indonesia. But 2 months ago, not today. This is for twice me to come here, okay? Mr. Ambassadors, would you explain by your own smart version between global economy and global healthy for global peace in harmony? Send this message for my people. What is the relation between global healthy, global economy, and global peace? Then for Mr. Abdu, also, would you share to me, maybe for some of us, the difference between globalization and Americanization? Because when I'm still kids in my country, where Obama also stayed there before, we always remind that Marlboro cigarette advertisement is correct. Number one in America, number one in the world, something like that. And then for Mrs. Jennifer Cates, please help Indonesia in global healthy before the next year's fall. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Len, would you like to start?
Okay, why don't I start off? The questions around, thank you very much for your very positive comments. Very much appreciated. I think around, you made two points. On new resources as versus, there was a lot of discussion, I think, at the the more technical level, not the Sherpa level, about this. And indeed, as Mark has pointed out, with respect to the American approach to defining the money, we had the same thing in Canada. We put aside money which was not committed yet to anything else, and we designated it as our $1.1 billion. And we were fairly insistent that that had to be the case. Now, the OECD was involved in some help in defining exactly what could be included in that. You know, for instance, some money on nutrition could be included, some money on general health could be included. We have the big global fund replenishment coming up. That's the next big health replenishment or funding item this year, and we're looking forward to a very substantial replenishment on that. And there was a discussion about the interface between the two, so we wouldn't get into double counting and so on. It's a highly technical thing. All I can tell you is that at the expert level, a lot of time was spent making sure that we didn't get ourselves into this situation of counting twice the same money. On the point about aggregate, we did agree at the end that we would report on an aggregated basis for the G8, and that's why the $5 billion figure in there. And we left it up to individual countries to say what they were going to be spending. We announced ours. The United States has announced theirs. Others have done the same thing. And to the extent that once they're announced, we'll track it against announced amounts. The issue of a strategy, the MDG summit, on recipients. You know, sometimes I ask myself when I listen to the quality of the discussion we had at the African outreach at the G8, just how much of a strategy you need now. Because African leader after African leader talked about their responsibility to use development assistance money effectively. I think the tone has changed. The environment has changed. There is a readiness to be accountable and to ensure that these monies are spent effectively, and they want them to be spent effectively. Another element of this thing that sort of crosses over, if I may do so, into the G20 is that, and again, United States leadership is important here. The anti-corruption initiative at the G20. And the whole issue of bribery and siphoning off of money, non-cooperative jurisdictions, it's a whole series of things there. Developing countries, leaders of developing countries are now very conscious of the fact that they don't want their aid money ending up in somebody's pocket. And again, the whole tone has changed. So I think, of course, I'm not going to be involved in the September meeting at the MDGs, but I feel that the environment already is very positive, but you know, maybe Mark has more specifics he could bring to that. On the final question, a very interesting one, because I think that's why my prime minister chose maternal and child health, chose the health field generally, and so forth, is because we all see, and he saw, the linkage between proper funding of health in developing countries against all of these other factors. And it hasn't been said, but it's worth saying, that a healthy young population, healthy mothers, lead to economic productivity in the developing countries. It's clearly linked with economic growth and development. We all know that. We just don't say it as often as we should. And, of course, economic growth brings more peace, more likely to bring stability. So these things link together. That's why the funding for health generally is, although it's often cast in aid policy terms, it's actually a foreign policy issue. It's fundamental to building block to international peace and security.
Mark?
Sure. On the U.S. commitment, $1.346 billion is additional to our fiscal year 2008 baseline, and I believe the methodological paper and some of the baseline information is published on the website of the Canadian Presidency, so I'd refer you to that, and you can read the details of, or the outcome of what was a long process of negotiation to develop a methodology. But our fiscal year 2008 baseline is $1.3 billion, and then additional to that baseline over fiscal year 2010 and 2011, we'll commit $1.346 billion. In terms of mutual accountability, I agree there's a sort of sea change in the way countries are looking at mutual accountability, and a number of statements from African leaders who attended the summit actually pointed to the need for mutual accountability and made specific reference to the 15% for health commitment from Abuja. And I think that if you look slightly beyond health and look at the Food Security Initiative, that's a really good example about how mutual accountability is playing out. The developing countries are doing exactly what they should be in developing multi-stakeholder country-led plans for us to help them fund, and they're being accountable for their part, and we're being accountable for our part, and I think that this serves as a good model going forward. In terms of globalization versus Americanization, you know, I really don't have a good answer for you on that. Globalization's got a well-known definition. I don't know that I know what Americanization actually is, and so I'm just going to pass on that one.
Thank you. On the corruption issue, just before the summits, there was a major study by one of the transparency tracking organizations that showed rather astonishing levels of capital flight, illicit capital flight, from African states in particular. And the G20, as I understand it, in one of the technical committees, the G20 agreed to consider, it did not commit, but it agreed to consider dedicating ODA monies in the future as a form of development assistance to the developing world. And here I think they were talking about African states, for bringing about more effective control mechanisms around illicit capital flight, which I thought was interesting, because there you had, the G20 sort of taking an incremental step that acknowledged a problem and was putting a sort of pragmatic focus upon the kind of fixes that might be possible in closing some of these gaps, but aware that the magnitude of the problem is rather prodigious. So there is this accumulation of sort of incremental steps being taken in these different portions of the G20. We're getting near the end of our time. Let's take just a couple of quick final comments. Dan, they're right here. I'm sorry. And behind you, and then...
Thank you. I'm Daniel Singer from the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development. The emphasis on accountability and anti-corruption mechanisms is certainly laudable. The outcome of that will inevitably be a requirement for more reporting, not just from the donors, but from the implementers and the recipients of funds. And one thing that you hear all the time from countries that receive aid is the burden that they face in multiple reporting mechanisms, multiple metrics, multiple systems through which they have to report the implementation of projects which are supported by donors. Where do you see the appropriate venue for trying to reconcile some of the international reporting to make it easier for countries? Should that be something that GA could focus on, or G20, or perhaps someplace else, so that countries could be more effective in reporting that they are doing what they've been funded to do?
Thank you. Right behind you.
Fernanda Lopez with the Yale Global Justice Program. My question concerns Ambassador Edwards, your discussion of the G8's new interest in developing health systems, and how the G8 has previously stated its commitment to eradicating, or at least placating, the neglect of neglected tropical diseases, and how this commitment was repledged in the recent Muskoka conference, and how it would plan to integrate this search for new innovative technology through an alternative health system when it pledges its new money for these projects.
Thank you. I'm going to add one closing question for our two speakers, which has to do with, if you imagine the G20 looking for the tie-in in between health and economic stability and growth, if the G20 leadership, both the G8 members and the G13 emerging markets, if they are thinking ahead and looking at where's the intersection of economic growth and stability and global health, there's a couple of things that pop out right away. There's pandemic preparedness, right, which is around stability and responding to emerging threats. There's trade, there's TRIPS, there's trade and health, there's intellectual property rights, there's viral sovereignty issues, very sticky, difficult, but fundamental to markets functioning. And there's the rising chronic disorders, the non-communicable diseases that are arguably galloping forward in the developing and the emerging markets in a way that's going to create enormous burdens on societies and economies in the future, and in which collective effort through the G20 might, again, in those areas, make the rational argument that health is, in fact, on the G20 agenda, fundamental to markets and economies and sustainable recovery and growth. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk about that as one, you know, just imagining where the G20 might move in the future, that would seem to be a very logical direction over time that they might migrate. So we have those three questions on the table. Len, would you like to start?
You raise a very interesting issue around reporting responsibilities and so on. I know we all face it inside our governments, the number of reports we all have to submit. Now we have to submit it to the G8, and we do it with the WTO and so on. I think that here, and I'm not the expert, but certainly around this kind of reporting, I think the OECD and the DAC can be very helpful. And I think using expertise there to try and regularize definitions and so forth, so we're not reinventing the wheel every time we prepare an accountability report. I think a lot of that happened this time around. So I think it's incumbent on our experts to continue to work to minimize the burden of reporting and to ensure that we're getting as much common definitional work, and so that the job done once can actually serve several purposes. So I think you raise a very, very good and important issue. On innovation in the health field, of course, the G8 has referred several times to innovative health and the importance for research and development. In fact, I think it was in L'Aquila we actually talked about it. We didn't bring that out this time under this initiative, but it's something that's back there. I firmly believe, personally, that the whole area of innovation and research, creating clusters of innovation in developing countries themselves, creating research capacities in indigenous universities and so forth, are really, really important. There's a really neat little initiative that we funded in Canada called the Next Einstein Initiative, which sets up, it builds on an initiative by a man called Neil Turok, who's at our Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, where he set up a mathematics school in South Africa, and we have announced some funding for several of those, and that gives you a perfect example of how you homegrown mathematicians are essential to scientific endeavor, to good governance, to a whole bunch of things, but you have to create them in developing countries. So that's why innovation, creating research and capacity in developed countries, is very important. And perhaps future chairs will pick that one up and run with it. Who knows? And then finally, your point, Stephen. I think we just have to let the G20 kind of feel its way on this. Mm-hmm. I can't read the future very well, but I think you're making some very, very good points about how the health agenda fits so snugly against. Against the economic growth, that it has to be seen through much the same lens, and I think that with time, I think this could well happen, but I think it's a little hard to predict.
Thank you, Mark.
With regard to Dan's question, reporting is a tremendous problem. I agree with Len that consistency in definitions and how we're using terms is useful. I would say that much of this, I think, has to be resolved by each country on its own. As you know, many of our reporting requirements are mandated by our legislative body. And as we move into the implementation phase under the Global Health Initiative, I know that there's a serious effort going on to look at how we can reduce transaction costs, both for our partner developing countries and for our staff in the field, in order to create more efficiencies and have more effective program implementation. And this is going to be a really important thing for the GHI moving forward. In terms of NTDs, again, I'd go back to the issue around the division of labor. And there's great work that's going on, both in terms of what governments are doing, but also in terms of what the private sector is doing in terms of donating drugs to treat neglected tropical diseases. And it's a really good example of how there's almost a sort of systemic look at what needs to be done and people lining up to play to their mutual or respective advantages. While we do need more drugs and better drugs in some instances, I think that there's a lot going on that both governments and the private sector can be very pleased about to move towards the control and elimination of many of those neglected tropical diseases. And finally, I would again have to agree that the G20 question is still very much a work in progress. The points that you made, Stephen, are very sensible and leading, but I think we'll need to wait a little while for it to play out to know which direction G20 is going in.
Thank you. We're nearing the end here. I'd like to ask Jen to offer some closing comments, and then we'll adjourn. Thank you.
Yeah, just one thought, or bringing it back to what the future holds, which none of us know. One of the challenges to really following what is happening in terms of donor government support, whether it's members of the G8 or beyond, is this lack of real-time information. And we struggled with that in our analysis. I think all of us struggle with that. And so I looking forward, we can see two different scenarios, the G8 legacy that you talked about continuing and health continuing to really play the role it has in official development assistance and really driving that forward even amidst the economic crisis for all the reasons we discussed, or the other way around, it flattening or even decreasing. We don't know which direction it's going to take. And I would just say that one of the things that, and maybe this is a role for the private sector, for research institutions, is to find more real-time ways to make those assessments so that we're not stuck in the situation of having lags and not being able to really look forward, given the fact that we, you know, just like an epidemic, the effects of lags in funding and resources are felt out over the years to come. And so you want to understand them ahead of time and get ahead of them. So if anyone has any thoughts about how to best do that, we have some at Kaiser, but I think that's really needed. And I also just want to thank both of you for your candid comments on all of this, especially right after the being in the midst of it.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us, and congratulations to the Canadians for successful summits.
Thank you. And thank you very much to the Center and to the Kaiser Family Foundation for giving us this opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks.